Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Phantom Galaxy, podcast for science fiction, fantasy, and horror in all of their many and varied forms. I'm your host, Nathan Bartlebaugh. Tonight's episode is one I'm actually very excited about. It's been a long time in the making, and it is the start of a series. Subject of the series? Howard Philip Lovecraft. Not just his stories, but also the work that his stories inspired. And if you're someone who's even briefly flirted with the genres of science fiction, fantasy, or horror, it's more than likely that you have heard of H.P. Lovecraft. You may know of him in a passing way and perhaps never actually read one of his stories. And if there's any question about just how much H.P. Lovecraft has influenced the culture, go back and listen to the opening music there. That is Acid Paradox's Cthulhu, featuring Nori on the soundtrack. And if you ever wondered if there was an H.P. Lovecraft dubstep out there, indeed there is, and you just heard a piece of it. And if you want to hear more, you can find them at soundcloud.com/acid-paradox. And you can also check them out on Facebook. Their Facebook page is Acid Paradox. Tonight's episode, we're going to be looking at the way that Lovecraft developed his writing style, where influences, things like that. We're also going to primarily look at adaptations of his work and how his work has been brought in and adapted into the mainstream. Future episodes, we'll actually look at his stories individually. We're going to have a reading of one of his stories coming up in a future episode, and we're going to kind of do an analysis of that story as well. So a lot of great stuff here, and I am very happy to announce that I am joined tonight by a good friend of mine who was one of the original members of the Pop Culture Ninja podcast all the way back in 2012, and which was a fun sort of experimental thing. Didn't quite take off, but I am very happy to have him here tonight. He also has just launched his own podcast. It is Going Deep with Seth Dombach. Over there you can find Seth talking about philosophy, ideas, and the cosmos. I've listened to the first episode. It's great. Check it out. We'll have a link in the show notes to the Podbean site where you can find it. Now, without further ado, I'm going to let Seth introduce himself.
Hi, everybody. My name's Seth Dombach. Nathan and I have been friends for a couple years. So I have written before, done some film criticism before, also write some short fiction and things like that. So I'm going to join him on this discussion on Lovecraft.
Yeah, and Seth is, I've mentioned a couple times, the original attempt at the Pop Culture Ninja podcast that involved sheets and tents and whatnot to block out the sound. Now, and Seth, you were with us for that, but thankfully I think you got to participate from your home and you were not a part of that entire fiasco. But we did a couple, did a couple fun interviews. I think we did one with the directors of Resolution, and they have a new movie coming out too. So that was a lot of fun.
And that was.
But Seth's going to join us more regularly on the podcast as well. So he's going to be a regular contributor. So tonight our episode is going to be focused around H.P. Lovecraft, because really there's no reason to have a podcast called Phantom Galaxy if you can't talk about H.P. Lovecraft at some point. Not everyone who knows of him or knows of his work is that familiar with all of his stories. It tends to be that someone knows either the Cthulhu mythos or something of that nature, or they're aware of how he's a part of pop culture ideas. But it's not necessarily true that everyone who can name drop him has even read some of his stuff, some of his fiction.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. It's actually funny because when I found out about H.P. Lovecraft, it was still kind of in the earlier days of the internet, and pretty much nobody at the time had ever, I'd never even heard the name of Cthulhu until I kind of stumbled across it by accident, and then got totally into Lovecraft at the time, and then since then, even more so. I almost kind of feel protective of Lovecraft in a way, and now when I see like how big Cthulhu has come into, you know, the consciousness, like Nathan had said, like he was in, you know, episodes of South Park, you see pictures of Cthulhu all over the internet, but I think people fail to really get into kind of H.P. Lovecraft as an author and see, you know, that there's a much bigger world that he built outside of just the Cthulhu mythos.
Yeah, it's one of those things where he's an author who has a very distinct identity in his writing, but that identity doesn't always speak to tentacle monsters and elder gods and things like that. That's certainly a large chunk of his work, but he really does come out of that sort of New England sort of supernatural tradition. You can trace some of his stuff all the way back to like Nathaniel Hawthorne, you know, some of his influences and inspirations. And there's a lot more to him, particularly when you read some of his stories, that you're kind of expecting something that's a little bit crazier, a little bit more out there. It's not that that's a part of it. I think one of the biggest probably impediments to getting really good stuff with Lovecraft, not with Lovecraft's original works, but everything that's come afterwards, whether you're talking about adaptations or you're talking about stories that draw from his influence, it's both been an impediment and kind of a boon, I guess, is that all of his work, because of the nature of what happened with the copyrights with Lovecraft, almost all of his stuff is in the public domain. And when things are in the public domain, they tend to become fodder for anyone who wants to do something by building off of somebody else's work.
Right, definitely. One of the things I love the most about Lovecraft is I think what he does better than many other horror writers is he really tapped into this sort of horror and fear that I don't think a lot of writers, you know, he's not just talking about ghosts, you know, this is not just, you know, oh, there's a noise in the darkness. His work is, there's something very deeply primal and terrifying about the things that he writes about. Now, I'm going to say, you know, just as my personal opinion, his dialogue is pretty bad, but his descriptive nature is really like sucks you in, and he's tapped into something that, you know, it's this outsider fear, it's this otherworldly fear, these things that, you know, your mind, the human mind can't even comprehend, that it'll drive you mad if you see these creatures that, you know, he's come up with. So there's something about the way that he writes a horror, it's almost like just that descent into madness is such a huge purveyor of, you know, and underlying in all his different stories.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think that is something that's missed when you focus on tentacle monsters and things like that, because one of the interesting things about Lovecraft, I think, is that most of his horrors, ultimately, they always had corporeal form. There was always a physical manifestation. But his work is really kind of, you know, what you're getting at with the dread and the sort of almost cosmic dissonance that comes with realizing that you're a very small part of some great plan that is ultimately a very bad one. I think the characters in Lovecraft stories, when they recognize the larger purpose of the universe, it's not a enlightening spiritual moment. It drives them to realize that they're basically an ant that's about to get smooshed. And this great force does have a plan for you, and you're probably going to be enslaved or eaten. And it's really not great for you. But existential is the word that comes to mind. You know, he kind of creates this sort of existential horror that a Lovecraft story is never, it's never about dying. What I mean by that is death is like the best possible thing that can usually happen to you in a Lovecraft story. It's not even always about the boogeyman under the bed. It deals a lot with perception and the mind, which kind of makes sense if you look at kind of his upbringing and where he came from. And if there's someone out there who's listening who hasn't even really heard of Lovecraft, or they've heard about Lovecraft, but they're more familiar with the name than they are the person, I mean, you got to remember that he's born in 1890. So, I mean, even some of this weird cosmic stuff he's writing, we look at it now and some of it seems quaint, but he's writing at a time when there's still a great deal of superstition in the world.
Right.
And as far as scientific reasoning goes, some of the ideas he's coming up with expand beyond even his own ability to know whether he's even in the right ballpark, if you will. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
When you talk about the sciences and astronomy and things like that, all of that stuff is happening, but when his stories start to go into these far-flung ideas, it's not like we have the same level of understanding about some things that we have now. So sometimes reading Lovecraft, you can sit there and think that some of his stories they feel like they could have been written 20 or 30 years later, but they really weren't. You know, a good bit of his stuff, I think about some of the latest is some of his stories are like the 30s, and most of his work is earlier than that.
Yeah, and if you do know like a little bit more about his history, you know, he was very sick as a child. He was barely ever in school at the time just because he was just so sick all the time. So, I mean, it kind of bleed into the way that he writes about things, you know, just kind of that bleak nature of his tales. Like, even with Poe, like, Poe had something that was a little bit more, he was more poetic. There was, you know, I don't know, there was, not that it was beautiful, but there was definitely a little bit more to his stories where we could, you know, you could see like some love in him, but there's nothing like that in Lovecraft's writing at all. It's not about like romance. It's about like the cold, dark truth behind the wall of consciousness that he saw, you know, and he was very into like astronomy and things like that, which you can obviously tell when you read a lot of his fiction of what's come through there. So I think his upbringing, you know, it was just like a perfect storm for the type of writing that he came up with.
Yeah, and from what I understand, he really, not only did he barely attend school, I don't think he was out of the house very much.
Yeah.
So he ends up being in this kind of scenario where he's left to his own devices a lot. His thoughts are kind of insular. And he also, there's a whole kind of deal where his father really becomes psychotic. That's like not long after he's born. He's like three. And when he dies, Lovecraft is only like 8 years old.
Yeah.
And he dies in a mental hospital and in Providence. And so like all of that stuff kind of takes its toll. It also kind of creates this feeling, I think, of that insecurity or that lack of feeling that there is a secure, everything's going to be all right. Everything's going to be all right is never a line that's even remotely uttered in any of Lovecraft's stories or anything that he writes. And it's funny you mentioned like Poe, who does have sort of a romantic vein, which makes sense. He's kind of, as an American, he's trying to tap into similar Victorian Gothic tropes and everything. And of course, Lovecraft draws on Poe some, but they share that outsider feel a little bit, and that feeling of someone who's always kind of the left of normal society for lots of different reasons, some of them being illness. And from what I understand, Lovecraft had an issue too with like germs, just the concept of germs, you know?
Yeah.
And that the way he reacted to that was kind of why he has this entire world of unseen monsters that will kill you, you know?
He also, like, his mother, she passed away, and I'm pretty sure he was very close to her, but she was also, like, was diagnosed with depression and hysteria, and that also draws really into a lot of the themes that you read in Lovecraft's work. It's always, like, this narrator or, you know, protagonist who is walking a very fine line between sanity and insanity. You know, those lines are very, very vague in his work. And you can just tell, like, how quickly he, you know, that once the veil is lifted, it's like, you not only like lose your mind, but you're thrust into this other world that, has unspeakable horrors in it. So I think that a lot of the things that he saw during his lifetime and that upbringing with, losing his father at so young and then dealing with his mother's mental issues, that's gone into his writing style, and that's why you see so many of those themes in his work.
Well, yeah, it's kind of really of a, it's very bizarre and a bit of a downer when you think about it, because he's kind of getting at most of his work, and we're going to talk about some more specific examples. It has that tread, but there's also that sensibility, that madness, losing your mind, quite literally just breaking from reality, is the place that most of us are going to end up when faced with the truth of life, what it really is. I mean, Lovecraft, he creates, it's interesting because he creates these great fantasias, these wonderful, very descriptive, very amazing worlds, that are phantasmagoric and exist beyond the veil and everything like that, but they're not remotely friendly or amazing. They're just dark, 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 dark. And even the dark forces that seem to rule these worlds, though, they're still kind of petty and indifferent. Like, they're not really on a higher plane than us. They just happen to be a lot bigger, and they have a lot more sway. They're just treating everything like it's chess pieces. So there's levels of insignificance where I think he's literally looking at, again, our relationship to bugs or germs, and saying that that's just going to go all the way up the ladder. And then you don't find a benevolent creator god at the top of that. What you find are a bunch of pissed off, like, petulant gods that just want to, gods of chaos and destruction that have been put away for a while, but they'll be back. Like, what we can look forward to is eventually the utter destruction.
Yeah, exactly. It's funny, like there's many different themes. Like I'd mentioned too, one thing that you will see a lot also in his work is this idea of a cursed bloodline, which I think also kind of speaks into where he ended up as well too. He died fairly young. I think he was only in his early 40s when he died. He was 46 when he passed away, but and he was completely poor, and just kind of destitute at the time that he died. And I think, that theme of like having that cursed bloodline is, you've seen where his family is. It kind of transcended onto him as well too.
Around this time, curses are something that people kind of put some stock into still, and particularly like in religious communities, there's still that sense of, oh, this can be chalked up to a curse. And Lovecraft, who, again, I don't think it's not probably by accident that some of our great horror authors all come out of New England, all the way down to Stephen King, that there's a great, in that particular vicinity, there's a lot to draw on. You have witchcraft, you have all of kind of some of the original American experience and everything that comes with that, and including all the myths that are brought over. Those 10 things tend to percolate a lot in New England, and so he's got all of that to draw off of, which does deal heavily in things like curses, things like dark histories, history that's passed down and handed off, either, like you said, kind of as a hereditary thing, or Lovecraft stories do also involve people who seem to possess this forbidden knowledge that's passed down. As many as we have people who learn about Cthulhu and go mad, we also have characters who are sort of the gatekeepers to that information, and you see that in a lot of different stories and in different ways. So he's what I think is interesting is you look at his background, and I think you do see him springing out of that kind of tradition, that you're coming out of an area that had a lot of very pious, superstitious thought processes. But any of these authors that are kind of going completely in the face of that and writing stories that are intended, really, I think, to just terrify that particular group of people. That Daniel Hawthorne is writing stories about the devil cavorting in the woods and things like that. And You've got Washington Irving, and they tell these stories that have the boogeyman always kind of right around the corner. And Lovecraft takes that one step further and says, "No, it's boogeyman all the way up and all the way down, and there's no way to escape it." That being said, it's interesting he's become so popular, being, that a lot of his work is so dark, so existential, and so really kind of serious. I think that's the thing that's hard to remember when you look at how Lovecraft is seen now. Because Cthulhu's almost like jokey. He's almost cute. My greatest disappointment is I've never been able to get that line of like kids stuffed animals out there,
Yeah,
like
the
I'd like to call them cuttlefish, like
plushie.
CUDDLE, that would be great, but I'm sure someone's probably beat me to it at this point. But yeah, plushie Cthulhu would be great. But when you look at his work, it's interesting that it's found its way into the zeitgeist to that degree. And again, I think a lot of it is people finding his work, finding, hey, you know what? I can kind of do whatever I want. I can take most of these ideas and form them into my own. But you had mentioned earlier, Seth, that like how you first came to Lovecraft. Do you want to talk about that a little
Yeah.
bit? Because I have my own, I'm thinking back to the first time I became aware.
It's funny. Like I've always been into horror since I was a little kid. I started off really with the Universal monsters, and then just kind of moved forward with that progression from there. Getting into Poe, and then obviously I got into King. But I came into Lovecraft later on in life. So I was probably about 16 or 17 in high school, and this was back in the 90s. So again, like I'd said, the internet was not what it is today. And we were assigned a project to talk about a different religion. So I somehow stumbled upon Lovecraft, and I stumbled upon the Elder Gods and Cthulhu. So I did my religion project on the Elder Gods, including a whole section on the Necronomicon, and I kind of fell in love with the whole world that he had built. That's one thing I really love about Lovecraft is he has this, everything feels interconnected, and you see that a lot in Stephen King's work, and that's definitely an influence from Lovecraft. But they have things like the Miskatonic University that shows up in many different stories, obviously Cthulhu and things like that. So I love that whole like world building that he has throughout his different tales. But ever since that time, I've just kind of been obsessed with Lovecraft and Lovecraft inspired things, even down to things like steampunk. Just how you can see his touch and how that influence in those t sort of tales has kind of grown from there. So that was my big introduction into the Lovecraft world. So Nathan, what was yours?
And I think you mentioned Stephen King, and I think that really some of mine was by kind of through that doorway, if you will, like reading some of Stephen King's.
Unknowingly.
What's that?
It's like you come to it unknowingly through King.
Right, because, yeah, and I was one of those kids that was reading Stephen King at probably like too young an age, like the middle
Yeah, me too.
school thing, because in middle school it was cool to carry around a book like It, even though it was realistic. People knew you weren't really reading that book. But I remember around that time I was reading books that were sort of above me at that level, but making my way through them and coming through, I think one of the first Stephen King books I actually owned was Night Shift, which is a series of short stories.
Yes,
And there's
yeah.
actually a short story, there's a couple short stories in that book that connect to Salem's Lot, which at the time I had not read. There's a story in there called One for the Road.
Yeah.
And there's another story in there called Jerusalem's, I
Yeah,
think so, Jerusalem's
Jerusalem's
Lot.
Lot. Yeah.
And it's the writing on that story is very Poe-like. You have a narrator who's in this old kind of dark mansion and is writing this story, and he's hearing rats in the walls. Rats in the Walls is actually a Lovecraft story,
Yeah.
and he keeps referencing the rats and what's in the walls and his whole writing style and the things he sees. And at one point, he encounters this sort of great giant thing that seems to be in the catacombs below the house, almost like a giant worm or something. And it was just
Right.
that concept there. There was nothing in that story that directly referenced Lovecraft. And I don't think that I even saw King necessarily himself say Lovecraft. But it was that first idea of this concept of the horror being much larger than a vampire, because Jerusalem's Lot, of course, we think of Salem's Lot dealing with vampires primarily. And yet, in this short story, he references something even more large and more and so kind of grand and loathsome that it just it changes the perspective. It changes the game, you know. It
Right.
isn't something you can even really deal with. It's older. It doesn't seem to really care. It's indifferent. And that indifference, that kind of malevolence, with mixed with a little bit of indifference about, you know, it wants to destroy the universe, but really, human beings will just be eradicated, basically incidentally, you know, just as
Yeah.
an afterthought.
Yeah,
And
and yeah, it's like even it ties even to Lovecraft, like the way that he had specific places in his stories that were kind of like conduits for evil, like Innsmouth and places like that, or like the Mountains of Madness. You know, like the like you'd mentioned, it's not just the vampires; it's the town that's cursed. It's this like beacon for evil that comes through this. So it's not just, you know, oh, something bad had come to town. It was like they're drawn to this place because it is, you know, just this where evil dwells because of like the cursed nature of this place.
right, and in looking at Jerusalem's Lot and kind of trying to find stories similar, I came across that led me ultimately to the Dunwich Horror, which
Yeah.
has a movie adaptation, which isn't particularly great,
Yeah.
but I think it's probably an understatement. But the Dunwich Horror has a lot in common with that story, but it also and it deals with some of those dark, menacing kind of cosmic terrors. But it also is really kind of a witchcraft story. The
Yeah.
Dunwich Horror, and that drawing me in that way, that's kind of how I came to Lovecraft. I came to a lot of different short stories of his initially. So I read some of those, but I didn't still didn't get quite into it. I wasn't aware, and I don't think back at that point, we're talking about the early 90s, the Cthulhu mythos isn't this thing that like it was being talked about in smaller kind of geeky circles, if you will. You
Right.
would find it referenced in Fangoria magazine or horror magazines, horror story magazines, but you weren't necessarily it wasn't just one of these things that all the cool kids know the way, you know, it sort of
Yeah.
is now. And it wasn't being built into as many things as we see. So that was kind of my introduction. Another probably bad introduction is that it was through the Full Moon movies. And I don't know if anyone
Yes.
who doesn't know, I probably already talked about this, but Full Moon, Charles Band is a director and producer who in the 80s was just kind of like was making as many cheap schlocky horror movies as he possibly could. He was like, I don't know if he was in a race with Roger Corman or not. He wasn't going to win that race, but like he formed this like company, Full Moon, which if it wasn't so low budget, it was actually a really cool idea, you know, that it would
Yeah.
get together and make all these movies. But the thing I remember most about Full Moon was that it would create poster art and it would create production design before there was ever a movie and before there ever may be a movie. And I distinctly remember posters for tons of Full Moon movies that were never ever made, even to this day. Beautiful, like almost heavy metal style illustrations. There was one for The Shadow Over Innsmouth that just showed this female merwoman kind of coming up out of the water and silhouetted against the moon. Beautiful image. Never,
Yeah.
they never made that movie. I think Full Moon eventually made The Lurking Fear. But so that seeing that and realizing it was based off Lovecraft made me consider that, oh, there's another angle here. So those are sort of my inroads. And I saw Stuart Gordon is obsessed with
Oh, yeah.
Lovecraft, and particularly back in the 90s. And he was actually supposed to be the one to make Shadow Over Innsmouth. He never got to make it. He eventually made a movie called Dagon, which is nothing at all like the short story Dagon that Lovecraft wrote, but is very much like Shadow Over Innsmouth. So
Yeah.
I don't know what was happening there. I don't know why. I don't know at that point why anyone thought Dagon was a more marketable title. But so that was kind of my introduction, if you will. And Cthulhu and everything else really came later. You know, I don't think I was as aware of Cthulhu. But I think as we go into this, one of the things I think it'd be interesting is to kind of do this as a series. And a good place to start, I think, for people who maybe aren't as aware of Lovecraft is to kind of talk about, because it's more likely they probably experienced some of his presence in movies and in TV or things like that, where, I mean, it's definitely been built into the zeitgeist. If you've watched and seen any sort of supernatural or fantasy kind of fiction, you've probably encountered some traces of Lovecraft in there, even if you're not directly horror. So I think a good starter episode might be to do that. We're also going to do, we have kind of a reading of one of his stories tried to pick something that has some touchstones with the Cthulhu mythos, but isn't really one of those stories. And that's a story called The Thing on the Doorstep. So Seth and I will kind of have a talk about that in a little bit. But what I thought would be good is let's talk about some of Lovecraft's adaptations, or how his work has been adapted from the stories into the mainstream. And I think future episodes, I really like to talk about who his inspirations were, who inspired him. We've talked a little bit about his background, but there are a lot of great authors that I think people are maybe even less aware of that were contemporaries of or preceded Lovecraft that are just as interesting as he was. But for tonight, I think I'd like to let's talk a little bit about his inspirations. And I think a good place to start is, Seth, what was the first adaptation of his that you saw or were aware of?
I would say probably the first thing that I'd seen, and I definitely saw this way too young, was Reanimator.
and that's pretty funny, all things considered.
I mean, the name of Lovecraft didn't resonate with me at the time, but, you know, being a kid who loved horror in the 80s and early 90s, you know, that was just one of those ones that you heard people talk about, so I had to see it. I've never actually read the story that it's based off of. I know it's a very loose adaptation of that, but
loose is a good, yeah.
Yeah. but that's a story that's very, it's still definitely very in the realm of what Lovecraft writes about. You know, obviously stuff like John Carpenter's work, you know, that's very influenced by Lovecraft. There's a lot of those. I'd say even though it's, you know, it's definitely, people tend to see it a lot more like a sci-fi, but The Thing has a lot of stuff that's, you know, it's that cosmic horror, you know, it's just that misshapen creature that's, you know, you can't even, it changes form so much, it's, you know, driving people mad. You know, there's so much out there that I'd seen that has that kind of touch of Lovecraft. Even, you know, even some of the stuff we've seen, like with Hellraiser, and, you know, there's so much of Lovecraft's influence on so many of, like, the modern, you know, horror masters. You know, they've taken so much from his work at that time. How about you, Nathan? What was one of the first Lovecraftian things that you were introduced to?
Like I say, the Dunwich horror, and I think part of that was because it was, I think probably rating-wise, it probably ends up being like a PG today or something like that. And it has a lot in common with some of those 70s haunted house movies. It doesn't quite play like that, but and I saw Reanimator, and unlike you, probably saw it way too young. And so, you know, The Thing, though, is just probably the worst part of this, is The Thing is probably the movie I saw before any of those.
Yeah.
And it does, even the original short story, Who Goes There, has a little bit in common with that Lovecraft feel, you know? And I think what's interesting is what we, in the Carpenter film, these people in an isolated area who discover this creature, and like you said, there's a lot of twisting, gloopy monsters, a distortion of the biological form, if you will. And that's kind of what you think of as the Lovecraft elements when you watch Carpenter's version of The Thing.
Yeah.
But when you read the short story, the it's that, again, that idea that the cosmos is a lot bigger than you expected it to be.
Right.
And one alien, one shapeshifter, one astronaut is here on Earth, and he causes all sorts of problems. And they find his ship, and he's planning to try and get out of there, and yet it's really just the tip of the iceberg. You know, this was one. The same way as one human being coming to another planet, the thing that the characters deal with is one. And one of many, you know. And so it's that, again, that kind of that cosmic unknown, that something bigger and worse is out there. And coupled with, again, there are some things worse than death. And in this case, it's what exactly happens to you when you are replaced by the thing.
Yeah, definitely.
And so Carpenter does that really well in that movie. The monsters are great, but it's a sense of the replacement. And it's handled differently than in a lot of its contemporaries, like Invasion of the Body Snatchers and things like that, that you would naturally think are the inspiration. Carpenter really delves into what it's like to be kind of reformed or remade by this thing. You know, the
yes.
fact that the thing goes through a weird sort of gestation period where it looks like other things. It isn't as simple as I touch you and then I look like you.
Yeah.
That's what happens. That's what seems to be happening on the surface when you walk into a room and you're not sure if your friend is your friend anymore. But on the back end, we see, like, there's a scene where it invades a bunch of dogs, that what happens is not really pleasant at all.
Yeah, to say the least.
It's that sense of, like, when you're a child for the first time, and you come across, like, a dead animal in the woods.
Yes.
Like a rabbit or a deer or something, and you walk up to it. And then there's that point when it's something you recognize, but when you pull that back, it's maybe covered by something, or you get closer and you realize there's maggots under the surface. It's kind of grotesque what I'm saying here, but you see the organs all laid out. And it's that writhing kind of chaos underneath what seems docile and serene.
Right.
And under life, there's death, but there's more than that. And that, I thought, Carpenter captures that sort of dread, that like that first time when you realize there's more going on here and that humans essentially are meat.
Yes.
I mean, that's kind of, you can kind of sum up the thing, the idea that humans are meat. That's not true of the Howard Hawks version that comes earlier. And that's probably not completely true of the short story, but I think it's true of the movie.
Yeah, definitely. There's two adaptations of Lovecraft's work that actually came out of Night Gallery, the Night Gallery series.
Night Gallery.
Yeah, they came out around the same time, maybe a little bit later than Twilight Zone. But they did an adaptation of Cool Air, and one of my favorite of his stories is Pickman's Model, which is actually a pretty decent adaptation that they do.
Did
Night
Gallery.
Gallery
do Pickman's Model?
They did, yeah.
That's fascinating, because I don't think I actually knew that, Seth.
Yeah, it's...
I love Night Gallery. I think the one that comes to mind is probably the one that comes to everyone's mind, the one with the earwig.
Yes,
the I'm earwig. Also a little yeah. surprised that Lovecraft didn't write. And I think we could talk more about that in the actual story at a different time.
Yeah.
Is the role that, like, art plays in that story.
Yes.
What we believe really to be art, and it's a little less than creative imagination by the end of the story. But that's interesting, because Night Gallery would always start with Rod Serling walking down a hallway full of paintings.
Yes.
Sort of pointing out how these aren't so much paintings as these are testaments to things that actually happened. And of course, each painting would eventually become a story and the basis for that episode. How was that? How was the actual episode? Because I feel like Pickman's Model is such a simple story that it would be very easy to mess it up if you're trying to do it right.
I from what I remember, and it's been years since I saw it, but it is actually a pretty decent adaptation of the story. And one thing that Gallery was really good at was building dread and bringing that into their tales. I'm always reminded of the one story where a man had died in his mansion, and he had a picture on the wall of, like, outside of the house. And every time the guy would come past the picture, this body was slowly, like, rising up out of the grave until it was coming into the house. So Night Gallery, but yeah, it's, I'll have to look and see if you can find it. I'm sure it's probably out there somewhere on YouTube, but yeah, it's a good adaptation of the story. And one thing, you know, Nathan and I had talked about too, is there's a lot more of, like, better influenced work from Lovecraft than there are direct adaptations of Lovecraft's work. So there's not so many great direct adaptations of his work, but you can see that influence throughout there. One thing I wanted to bring up, speaking of Carpenter, is he did a movie in the 90s, the early 90s, called In the Mouth of Madness. For me personally, I think it's one of the better if like a primer for Lovecraft, because it has all of kind of the trappings of Lovecraft's work, and it kind of like centers around a writer who in a way is like Lovecraftian and in his sort of tale. So you would see a lot of the themes of Lovecraft. So if you haven't read any of Lovecraft before and you kind of want to, get an idea for what am I going to be in for when I read his type of work? I think In the Mouth of Madness is kind of a good primer because it captures a lot of those ideas of those otherworldly creatures and losing your sanity and the way that, it can take over and change the way that you see the world, and knowing that there's something else out there, in this short veil that you can push aside, and it brings over an entirely different and frightening parallel universe to ours.
Yeah, and Mouth of Madness too is very much inspired by Love. I mean, it wears those influences on its
Oh,
sleeve
yeah.
in a lot of ways, and it has the tone of really a Lovecraft story, I think. When it came out, I think I was because Carpenter's had such a distinguished career. When it came out in the mid-90s, I think people were expecting a lot more from it,
Yes,
and it's
yeah.
probably definitely sort of like milder Carpenter. I don't necessarily mean that in terms of the themes and what's going on, but I think that it's not necessarily like top tier Carpenter. It's still an interesting movie though, and the town that they create, Hobbs End, I believe, is one of those towns that feels very much like the towns you'd see in a Lovecraft story.
Yeah.
And there is that feeling of the Elder Gods creeping closer, even though we don't use the term Elder Gods. There's a scene in that, and there's a lot of tentacles. My memory is there's a
Yeah.
lot of tentacles. But there's a scene in that film. The movie stars Sam Neill, who I think did an excellent job.
Yeah, he's great in it.
And to be fair, he's good in most of the things he does. But this was one of his movies coming off of Jurassic Park, and
Yeah.
he's really good. And I think that the movie is kind of overlooked and underrated in a lot of ways. But there's a scene where at one point he has started to flee from Hobbs End and from this writer who I think his name is Sadr Kane, if I remember
Yeah,
correctly.
yeah.
Sadr Kane is obviously kind of like he's you know I think he's SK Stephen King, like Stephen
Yeah.
King, and but the worlds that Sadr Kane writes seem to actually exist in a place out there, and Neil's character, who is kind of his replacement agent, has found this place, and he's running from essentially. The pages of the book seem to tear open, but really it's the fabric of reality is ripped. And there are hundreds of these monstrous things chasing him. And you never really see them in close detail. You just get the impression that they're sort of chasing him through the dark. And Neil's in the foreground and the creatures are in the background. I always thought that was a really neat kind of shot, and
Yeah.
that the movie doesn't ever quite like pay off most of those things. But it does a good job of capturing, I think, that sense of paranoia that's really based in the outlandish. You know, it's one thing
Yes.
to be paranoid that someone's going to break into your house and kill you. It's another thing to be paranoid that alien tentacles from another star system will come and just ravage you and your family. But that doesn't really make it any less threatening. And so, yeah, Mouth of Madness was an interesting kind of amalgamation because it didn't just deal with Lovecraft, but it also kind of dealt with his influence and how he's affected everybody else. So authors out there like Whitley Strieber and Stephen King and Clive Barker, I mean, Clive Barker, I think, and probably he would admit the same, probably owes a lot to H.P. Lovecraft.
Yeah.
And though I will give Barker credit in the sense that Barker, most, I've read many of his books, and Barker captures that tone, that kind of, again, the phantasmagoric, I would say. He's interested in what happens to the, not so much in death, but in the body being broken down. But Barker almost has a weird kind of twisted view that, like, if you really want to transcend and get to the spirit, you're going to have to tear through the flesh first.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a gross idea, but it also is an idea that in its own way, does explore kind of a certain side of spirituality. It's a very weird the way Barker does that.
Yeah.
But I give him credit because I don't think he's ever openly referenced. He doesn't just take what Lovecraft has done and like build it in. He's never referencing Cthulhu or anything of that nature. He keeps his work 100% original, but it has the feel and I think he's digging at the same wound, if you will, that Lovecraft was.
It's did you ever see there was it was kind of like a Creepshow type film. They did Necronomicon, Book of the Dead, where they adapted three of Lovecraft's films. Jeffrey Combs was in it. I think Brian Yuzna directed it. I think Christopher Gans did one of the stories in there. The guy did Brotherhood of the Wolf. It's not good. I will tell you that right off the top.
No, it isn't good. You're absolutely right. It's not good. And also, not only did Christoph Gans direct Brotherhood of the Wolf, he later did Silent Hill. Silent Hill movie.
That's true.
Which Silent Hill owes a lot to Lovecraft. But Necronomicon was pretty poor.
Yeah.
and honestly, I think it's not wrong to say that a lot of the Lovecraft movies that are out there are pretty particularly the ones done in the 80s, are kind of poor. And I think it's the same reason some of Clive Barker's stuff, Barker directs a lot of his own stuff, but some of his stuff is not very good, is because it's very hard to... You mentioned, you know, often Lovecraft would say things like, this thing is so horrible, it drives someone insane.
Yeah.
And he might leave it at that. We might not get much more description than that.
Yeah.
This thing was so crazy, it made me go mad, so mad I can't tell you what it looked like. And
there's a lot of stories that end that way.
Yeah, I always remember Chris and I joke because C.S. Lewis would write the same way. And children, these things were so awful. If I tell you about them, you'll have nightmares. So I was like, oh, that's convenient. But you were able to tell me every detail of what Lucy and Susan had for breakfast.
Right.
But so I sometimes wonder if these authors weren't just trying to like get away with, you know what, it's always scarier what you imagine on your own. So I'm going to let you imagine this entire thing on your own. And it seems to have worked out. But so when you try to visualize them in a film, latex and special effects and animatronics don't always do them justice.
Right.
And I think if The Thing had only been latex and special effects and animatronics, you didn't have all those scenes where you're questioning who's who and who has their identity, the movie wouldn't be successful. And unfortunately, a lot of the Stuart Gordon movies and a lot of the Brian Yuzna movies are just about goopy special effects.
Right.
And again, that deal of there not really being a lot of hold on the copyrights, you would end up with these movies that were kind of just half put together. And the Dunwich Horror is one of them. There's a movie I remember as a kid called The Curse. And The Curse is actually... It spawned its own series in the 80s, but you probably remember this, Seth. Franchises in the 80s were a very different thing, particularly
yes.
horror franchises. There was never an expectation, and there was certainly not a need that a horror franchise would connect the dots, meaning
right.
part one might have not a friggin' thing to do with part two.
Right.
I mean, that's even true of the Halloween franchise, where you had a built-in monster like Michael Myers. Halloween 1 and Halloween 2 are absolutely about Michael Myers. But, of course, the original Carpenter idea was that each Halloween would be about something different.
Right.
And they tried that one time with Halloween 3, The Season of the Witch.
Which
they were like,
people
no.
People like that movie again, though.
You know what? And it's a weird movie, but and you know what? If you think about it, if you watch Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, and you watch In the Mouth of Madness, there are a lot of comparison points.
There are, yeah.
The basic tone is almost identical. The basic thrust of the film is almost identical. Carpenter didn't direct Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, but I know he had a hand in it. Season of the Witch, and I'll be honest, it's a much more interesting movie than any of the sequels that follow.
Oh, I was going to say, yeah, I'd take like 20 more Seasons of the Witch as over like a Halloween Resurrection.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, nothing that really followed was very good in that vein. But there was a movie called The Curse, and Will Wheaton was in it. It was done in the mid-80s, thereabouts. It wasn't particularly a big budget. There is an actor in that, Claude Akins, who, if you're familiar with older movies and in general, you've probably seen Claude Akins. He was in The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street, which was, of course, that kind of famous Twilight Zone episode where
episode.
All of the neighbors are kind of questioning who, you know, the aliens are here and who are they really. So
right.
The Curse was based off a story called The Color Out of Space. And this is one of those stories disconnected from the Cthulhu mythos, but still taps into that idea of cosmic terror and of human beings sort of being at the mercy of something terrible. Interesting fact about The Curse, it was directed by David Keith. Not to be confused with Keith David. But David Keith, anyone who's listening to this may remember him from, he played the father in the Firestarter movie. And the Firestarter movie with Drew Barrymore from, I think, 1983
yeah.
or whatever. And he's been a lot of stuff, but I'm not certain if he ever directed anything else. One would hope that after someone saw The Curse that was probably it. I think he has two other credits to his name. They're not movies I recognize, but The Curse is pretty friggin' horrible. Now, when I saw it as a kid, it was that kind of horrible that still freaked me out. I don't know if you've had this experience, but sometimes when you see a really cheap movie, as a kid, it can be almost more disturbing than
yes.
something that's big budget, because I don't know. I always get this feeling of like, how did they get away with this? You know,
yeah.
a big budget movie, you might recognize an actor, see someone you know. And I did recognize, like, oh, look, Will Crusher's in this movie. How bad could it be? And Star Trek, honestly, was only a couple of years in at the point when this movie came out. And that's probably the reason I kept sitting there watching it, thinking, oh, like, how bad can it be? And yet, the more low budget something is sometimes, and the creepier and weirder it seems, you almost feel like it slipped out of the cracks totally altogether. And like, well,
right.
did anyone really make this? Maybe, maybe they just put
appeared.
It on a video store shelf so I would find it. Now I'm watching it and God knows what happens next. Like, there's that sense of safety is kind of off when you're watching something that you're not sure. How did it get here? Maybe yeah. I would have felt more comforted if I'd known David Keith had directed it back then.
Well, if you do want something a little scarier than The Curse with David Keith in it, he was in the recent make of Christian Mingle, the movie, that back in 2014.
Wait. Christian Mingle is a movie?
It is a movie, yes. Starring Lacey Chabert.
Please tell me it was like a horror film where like the Christian Mingle thing goes horribly wrong and Lacey Chabert ends up with David Keith.
You want to know who directed? I know we're getting off tangent.
Rennie Harlan.
No, Corbin okay. Burnson.
Corbin Burnson. He was in the middle of making dentist movies,
yeah.
and he had a day off.
One movie, it's like I said, it's not a straight adaptation, but we have talked about a few that are not so great. So I do want to bring up one that I am highly recommending anybody go and check out right away. It's definitely an influence by, it's also kind of influenced by Arthur Machen, the guy who wrote The Great God Pan.
Yes, who was a big influence on Lovecraft himself.
Yeah.
And The Great God Pan is an awesome story.
Yeah, it's very, a great story. But this is on YouTube. You can go find it. It's only about 30 minutes long, but it's a Marvel adaptation of Stephen King's story N. Just the letter N.
Oh, that is really good. Yeah.
Yeah. If you're looking for something inspired by Lovecraft and definitely like has that feel of a Lovecraft story, and I think it's pretty freaky, and it's just kind of like an animated short, but it's a story about a man who's, you know, you think he's going crazy. He's obsessed with these standing stones he finds in a field and trying to like keep numbers straight so he can keep the world from falling into darkness. Like I said, it's very short, but it's totally worth your time, and the full thing is on YouTube. So I highly recommend anybody go out and search that one out.
Yeah, and as we've already said, Stephen King has a lot of, I mean, he will directly reference Lovecraft.
Yeah.
You mentioned Arthur Machen, so it's probably, I mean, it's probably a great place to mention that one of King's recent books, Revival,
yes,
has a lot in common both with Machen and with Lovecraft, and I give it credit for actually, like, it. I don't want to spoil it just in
yeah.
case anyone, you know, out there hasn't read it, but and some people had an issue with the ending. I personally thought it was a great ending.
Perfect ending.
Yeah, perfect ending. But also, King is a guy who I think sometimes wants to hold back. He has a little bit of Steven Spielberg in him where he wants to give you the happy ending.
Yeah.
He wants to kind of pull back, give you the lollipop, pat you in the back, and Uncle Steve says everything's going to be okay. And I don't really think he does that with Revival. Revival's
no.
got one of the,
that's
like,
a dark ending.
It's a dark ending, and it's a Lovecraft ending all the way. It's the most Lovecraft ending outside of Lovecraft
yeah.
that there probably is. So Revival is excellent. I mean, I honestly think that it's as good as some of his older work.
Yeah.
And then that's probably for a different podcast. To go briefly back to The Curse, yeah, Curse is kind of a trashy movie. Inspired a lot of sequels. There was Curse 2: The Bite, which was about a snake man, and had nothing to do. Curse 3, and actually, what's interesting about the Curse movies, they apparently were made as completely different movies and just slapped on with the Curse title.
Oh,
I
so
don't
it's
know
a
why this
troll
happened.
situation?
It kind of is, but it's even worse because these movies, I don't think The Curse was a title that inspired confidence, so I'm not sure why you would want to put them under the banner. There are four Curse movies. Curse 3 is this like African horror movie, and Christopher Lee is in it briefly, and
Huh.
there may or may not be a monster. It's not very good. Curse 4, The Catacombs, is I think it might be an Italian film or something. It's a low budget movie about this monk and his young protege trying to protect something from getting out of the catacombs. It's actually not a bad movie. It's better than anything with the Curse name on it. Has very little to do with Lovecraft. None of the other movies do. Feel free to avoid The Curse. The only thing I remember this day was Claude Akins smacking Wil Wheaton in the face while he's kind of coming apart because the water's infected and people are turning into glop. And there was a scene where I think Wheaton's mother, his kind of obnoxious older stepbrother, has had the barbed wire fence fall on his butt, and she's trying to medicate it and sew it up for him. And he's like, "What are you doing, Mom?" And she's like, "Connecting the dots." And she's going crazy, and just sort of, you see that she's kind of stitched what looks like the Big Dipper in the back of this kid's like bodice. So don't bother to seek those out. Another movie you can completely skip. They did The Unnameable and The Unnameable 2.
Oh no, I forgot about that.
I think I remember John Rhys-Davies was in one of those movies, possibly the first one. There's an ancient demon, and it also turns out to be a hot pinup model at the same time. Those movies always work out great. Full Moon, which we already talked about, did finally make a version of The Lurking Fear.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, was that like that was 90s, wasn't that?
I wonder if Gordon was. I don't know if Gordon may have actually directed that. All I remember is it had. No, Gordon totally did not direct that.
Did he do Castle Freak?
He did do Castle Freak, which is also, I believe, a Lovecraft story.
Yeah, and From Beyond, but I th was it From Beyond, was that Stuart Gordon too?
From Beyond is worth talking
That's a
about.
good movie. Yeah.
I don't really think much of Castle Freak personally.
Yeah,
It's got
Castle
Jeffrey
Freak's not that
Combs doing
great.
his weird thing. I think the most terrifying scene of Castle Freak was the very beginning. There's an old lady slicing an old log of sausage.
Oh
That always
yeah.
bothered me for some reason. I mean, but
It's a
that one seemed
Freudian
to.
thing.
Yeah, exactly right. I think all the scenes later of the Castle Freak assaulting various members of Combs' family and beating Combs with like chains and whatnot. It was the sausage that bothered me. But From Beyond, as I'm thinking about it, that was also unfortunately one of my early. Ex That was probably the first exposure. Now that you actually say that, because Channel 54, and that's what Channel 54 was for us. Everyone has that station that plays the crap that like, and I know you probably have seen like you're familiar, Seth, like I am with things like Creepypasta and whatnot. I'm always waiting for the day when it's revealed that Channel 54 was just in my head and I was watching static for an hour on television, like Candle Cove. So I remember seeing From Beyond that Channel 54 would always do these horror movies on like a certain night of the week, and they would kind of be almost like a marathon, every night. And for some bizarre, sick, and twisted reason, they always seemed to do it right around like the holidays. So you'd be around like Christmas, be like, come, you're like, oh, I'm ready to watch a movie now. I'd see some horrible like From Beyond. It would just basically ruin the holiday for me. So everyone's thinking about Santa Claus, and I'm thinking about your head being torn off and eaten by like giant cosmic parasites. So, From Beyond was one of those movies that was playing on like network television at like 8 p.m. on a Thursday. I don't know who programmed it, but that was a mistake. And granted, can't show everything, but I mean, what a crazy movie
Oh,
From
it's
Beyond
wild, yeah.
is.
It's also one of the because it's fairly gory.
Oh, it's intense. I mean, probably in these days we would be pretty much nonplussed by it, but given in the day, it was pretty rough.
Yeah, and it's one of those rare, weird horror movies that Siskel and Ebert actually liked. They both gave it a thumbs up.
Yeah, and I always thought it was strange because Siskel was even more, I think actually, initially, I think Ebert was like right on the fence. I think he's like a 2.5-star kind of deal.
Yeah.
One of those deals where I think he just gave it a thumbs down just so he could be, you know,
the
be the opposite of Siskel. Exactly. Yeah. But Siskel was a guy who never liked extreme violence in horror films.
No.
He would thumbs down a movie because of that. And yet, every once in a while, a weird movie like Funhouse.
Yeah.
He was a big fan of Funhouse. He was a big fan of this movie, and he liked this movie. It might have been the same show or two shows separate. He liked this movie, but did not like Aliens.
Yeah.
And I remember him kind of using this as an example of why he didn't like Aliens. He felt that this movie was more fun and it had a more of a sense of humor. That might be true, but it's a pretty weird, disturbing movie, and it seems like it ends about three times. Like,
yeah.
Once it's wiped out all of its primary characters, you think the movie can't possibly go on, but it still does.
Yes.
I mean, Combs runs around half this movie with a worm. It looks like a little phallus sticking out of the center of his head. And it's like his pituitary gland. It's such a weird movie. I remember Ted Sorrell plays like Dr. Pretorius.
Yeah,
remember
Dr. Pretorius.
In the very beginning. And I just remember Combs trying to describe what's happened to him and says, well, I watched it bite his head off like a gingerbread man. Now, again, that wasn't great holiday imagery for me. But it's weird. It's a strange movie. And yet, I believe there's also, because Combs loses his hair halfway through, because I believe a giant tapeworm sucks it off.
Yes, yep.
Okay, good. And now I will probably watch this movie and concede that the tapeworm probably looks like a giant trash bag. But at the time, those ideas and concepts were very terrifying. I mean, Pretorius turns on this machine and in the first 2 or 3 minutes of this movie, little monsters are floating around that are apparently always been in the air, but only now can you actually see them. I mean, it's a trashy movie, though.
Yeah.
I mean, let's be honest.
It's fun, though. It's a fun, trashy movie.
I like it better than Reanimator, personally. I think it's more fun. It's more true to the spirit of Lovecraft. Now, that being said, you look at some of Gordon's other movies. He did not direct The Lurking Fear. I really wouldn't recommend The Lurking Fear. I do remember that that Vincent Chiavelli was in The Lurking Fear. That's about all I remember. The short story's pretty good, though. Dagon is probably the other Stuart Gordon Lovecraft movie of note, would you say?
Yeah, I would definitely say that. And I think people who are at least genre fans have probably heard of it if they haven't seen it, but that's one of those ones that does get tossed around, as you know, when you're talking about Lovecraft adaptations.
It could be a lot better than it is,
yeah.
I feel like. It has the feel of, it probably was when it came out, almost direct-to-video.
Yeah. It's definitely a movie that was filmed in Italy.
Yeah, and every actor is Italian. I mean, it's clear that there's nothing New Englandy about this at all.
There are some creepy moments in it. Like some of the feel of like the townsfolk when they show up is definitely a little creepy. It's got one of the best looking skinning scenes I've seen in a movie, which is, it's very brutal and it comes out of nowhere for that movie because it's not very gory other than that one scene. But it's ultimately not a great film.
No, it tries to capture, and it really is, I think, as we've already said, it really is a shadow or Innsmouth is a story it's based off of. It has not a thing in common with Dagon,
no.
The short story. I don't even remember the flaying scene you're talking about, but I do remember the guy finding the fish princess or whatever she was in his bed and being sort of alarmed that from the waist down it was sort of like some sort of I don't remember if she was a fish or she had tentacles or what the deal was, but that what he thought was going to happen wasn't going to happen anymore.
Yeah.
and that seems to be like the most horrific scene in the movie in some ways, you know. He's like, oh no, the bottom half's a fish. And
some people might be into that, though. You never know.
Yeah. Well,
it's a wild
world.
Right.
I'm sure you can find a still of it online. So some of the movies that I think were successful, because right now it's just like They're talking about all the things that aren't successful.
Yeah.
And book-wise, I think people there's been some really good stuff written out there that takes Lovecraft and then bases off of it. I think Gordon always wanted to be the guy to do a legitimate, and when I say legitimate, do something that really was a good Lovecraft like story.
Yeah.
But I just don't know that he ever really got there. I
No.
mean, he's not a great filmmaker in my opinion.
No. There's good
Got a lot of
attempts.
energy. He has a lot of energy. He
Yeah.
really wants to be. He's earnest. But I mean, when you find yourself saying things like he has a lot of energy and he's
Yeah.
earnest, it usually means he's not a great that his attempts aren't always successful.
Yeah.
But one of my honestly, I think one of the best Lovecraft movies I've seen was an adaptation of, and you may not have seen this, Seth, I'm not sure, an adaptation of Call of Cthulhu, and it was done.
Are you talking about the silent one?
Yeah.
Yeah, I
Have you
have
seen
seen
it?
that. Yeah, it's really good.
It's really cool. I saw it years ago at the Maryland Film Festival. They debuted it there, and it was, I don't know if they debuted it there, but it played at the film festival. And it was done, it's kind of done like the Lovecraft LARPing Society or something. I mean, it
Yeah.
was basically done by a group of like people that were really into like role playing like H.P. Lovecraft. And from what I understand, they basically were, it's funny because I always think this sometimes about people that it's totally fine to be into role playing, but and then role playing I'm kind of talking about isn't dressing up in whips and chains, but rather more like Dungeons and Dragons kind of deal. But that, you know, I was just talking to a friend the other day who was talking about playing like an 8 hour game of Dungeons and Dragons that was part or of like a Dungeons and Dragons campaign that is part of a 15-year campaign that this guy had been playing. My friend who had only been doing it for the past year or so, but this thing's been going for 15 years. And his statement was, man, at this point the guy should probably just write a book.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of like that's what happened here is they got together and were doing these in-depth role plays of H.P. Lovecraft, and then suddenly you kind of realize we should just film this.
Yeah.
And yeah, the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society is the production company on this. I don't know that they ever did anything else, but Andrew Lehman's listed as a director here on IMDb. This is only 47 minutes long. You can
Yeah.
probably find it on YouTube,
It is on
but
YouTube.
it captures almost perfectly the feel of Lovecraft's story.
Yeah.
But it does it in a silent film way. There's a stop motion Cthulhu in it. It's just neat. It's
Yeah.
definitely, you're not going to mistake this for a big budget production. This
No.
isn't going to be visceral and just you know, this really realistic movie, but it captures the tone of Lovecraft by it's one of the few movies I really in 2005 it was a little more interesting when people were doing this, but I really am not a big fan of when people just try to kind of copycat a work style, you know.
Right.
Oh, we'll make my movie great by making it look like a silent film, or I'll make this movie great by making it look like a 1930s serial, you know.
Yeah.
Those things to me don't work unless you really know what you're doing.
Yeah.
And Cthulhu, again, it's 47 minutes long. It was looking for a novel way to, they had no money and they wanted to make a really neat Lovecraft movie. And so what they did is they went back to a certain style of filmmaking, a style of film that would have been around when Lovecraft was writing, and they do a pretty good job with it.
Yeah.
I'd say it's probably the most true of almost and true to the source material and true to the theme. I like it a lot,
Yeah,
really. I
it's
think it's
good.
worth watching. You're not going to get your giant CGI Cthulhu or anything like that, but it's pretty good. I'm trying to think of what else. I mean, recently, on this episode, Chris Durham and I have a review of the movie The Void. I thought The Void did a nice job of both being like Carpenter and Carpenter channeling Lovecraft and like Lovecraft himself.
Yeah.
There's a lot to like in that movie. They
I think
did a well, go ahead.
there's two other ones that they're not direct adaptations, they're influenced by, but these are two ones I would probably recommend for the most part. One definitely more than the other. The first being Hellboy. Guillermo del Toro is huge influence by Lovecraft. He was slated for ever to do the Mountains of Madness, but that has fallen through, and I don't think that's going to happen ever. But you can see a lot of
No, and that's a
Lovecraft's.
shame.
Yeah, I think he could have done a great job with that. But I don't think that's ever going to happen. But there's a lot of Lovecraftian elements in Hellboy, especially some of the Elder God kind of stuff is in towards the end of that movie. But another one that's in that realm, it's by Stephen King, it's The Mist. I think The Mist has a lot of Lovecraft influence to it too. And I really recommend The Mist if you haven't seen it. Definitely seek out the black and white version if you can find that one directly. That's kind of Darabont's director's cut of The Mist. And it actually kind of helps with some of the CGI that's not really that great in the movie, but it's a good movie. I think it's one of the better horror movies that's come out in the past like 10, 15 years. But I definitely highly recommend that one.
The Mist is good. At some point, well, one of the future episodes that Seth and I are going to do is looking at Stephen King adaptations, and I think we're going to be committed to doing all of them, as many as we've seen. And The Mist is coming. I don't know what you think about this. Mist is coming to Spike TV this summer.
I've seen some of the trailers for it. Yeah, I'm not. I don't really know how to feel about that yet.
It looks like they're just making. I remember when I was in eighth grade and they wanted to, as a writing exercise, just because I guess they were trying to get kids to write, so they'll give you all kinds of harebrained things. They wanted you to write a sequel to something. And so I remember trying to write a sequel to The Mist. And I look at the trailer for The Mist and I'm like, wow, that's so much like what I wrote. But I don't trust eighth grade me to write a movie. And I'm not sure that anyone that went the same direction I did has made a movie I want to watch. So we'll see. They definitely have decided to expand the role of the Arrowhead Project in that. But The Mist is a good movie. The Mist is a great short story. It definitely has Lovecraft elements there. You mentioned Hellboy. I actually love the Hellboy. I actually like real I both I like both of the
Yeah, they're
Hellboy
both
movies a
good.
lot. Mike Mignola's Hellboy universe really does delve into some kind of Lovecraft elements, but definitely Del Toro kind of goes full bore with the Abdullah Jihad or whatever, these giant sort of like octopi creatures that are trapped in some sort of crystal out in space. It's pretty cool. If you haven't seen them, and they are PG. I'm disappointed to hear that Del Toro and Ron Perlman have been schlepping about for years trying to get Hellboy 3 made, and now they're going to make a new Hellboy,
Yeah, doesn't make
but it's
sense.
going to be R-rated, and it's going to be directed by Neil Marshall, who did The Descent, and it's going to star David Harbour, who played the sheriff in
Oh,
Stranger
Stranger
Things,
Things, yeah.
which is maybe the only part of
That's a
that I even
decent
like.
casting choice,
That's a
yeah.
nice casting, but I mean, I think of Perlman now, and I mean Perlman went to like a dying kid's like make a wish to be Hellboy. I mean, why can't he do this again?
He was
I just
perfect for Hellboy.
it was, and it, I just I it's one of those few things. I mean, I'm not a boycott, but I just have no interest in it. Like,
Yeah.
you have people over here who really have a desire to make it, who would make it with passion, and I don't think. I mean, Marshall's fine, but I mean, outside of The Descent, I don't think he's made a movie I've really liked that
Yeah,
much.
I think he's got two good movies, Dog Soldiers and The Descent, and that's pretty much it
Yeah,
for him.
like, I mean, I think he did Doomsday and Centurion after that, and I didn't really care much for either one of those.
No.
But so in the Lovecraft way, there have been a couple others. I don't know, not like you said, not direct adaptations. Did you ever see The Last Lovecraft?
No, I did not see that.
So the last Lovecraft was an attempt to kind of make a kind of horror comedy, kind of their Evil Dead version of like a Lovecraft movie. And the only thing I really remember, well, I remember a couple things about it. I remember that, you basically have these two Lovecraft nerds finding out that one of them is possibly related to H.P. Lovecraft. And so they have to go, and in the beginning of the movie, there is literally this really purposely bad, almost crayon animation of showing Cthulhu come to Earth in previous times and conquer the life forms there. And at one point, he comes into the dinosaur age and the Mesozoic era, and he literally has a Triceratops head, his fist rammed inside of a Triceratops head, and he's punching a Tyrannosaurus in the stomach with it.
That's great.
And the one of the main characters walks around for the whole movie with a shirt that says, "My other car is a Shoggoth," or "My other ride is a Shoggoth," or something. And I think it used to be on Netflix. It's not as good as it should be, but it's amusing. It was definitely done in a silly style. It had monsters and the tentacles and everything you expect, and the sea shanty about being accosted by fish people.
Yeah, if I can find that, I'm definitely looking at that.
The Last Lovecraft, it was called The Relic of Cthulhu, and the director was Henry Sayne, who did a movie called Bounty Killer, which was like a kind of silly Mad Max throw-off. It looks like now he is pretty much working on things like the Mindy Project and stuff like that, like in the art department, the Children's Hospital. But so he hasn't made anything since, movie-wise, since Bounty Killer, which was in 2013. But The Last Lovecraft, The Relic of Cthulhu, and it looks like it's on Amazon. I think you can rent it there for a couple bucks, but it used to be, it was on Netflix at some point. It also a movie that I remember seeing, and I honestly don't know if it was, if it's still out there or available or not. And I mean, it, and you'll hear me very rarely say there's an interesting movie that had Corey Feldman in it, but more like adult Corey Feldman, not cute little Corey Feldman from the 80s. And I want to say this movie came out 2008 or 2007. It was a movie called The Birthday, 2004. So The Birthday, it also has a horror comedy feel to it, but it takes place in a hotel where Feldman is this young guy who's going to his girlfriend's father's birthday party. He's in a hotel. But at the same time, in another apartment or another hotel room, there's a group of people getting ready for the birth of their god. When Feldman finds himself in the wrong hotel room for a period of time, wackiness ensues. But it's actually pretty good. I don't know if it's on YouTube or not.
I've never
but
heard
it's
of that.
The Birthday. It goes on for too long. It really probably should be a short film, I think. But it's very weird. It's enjoyable. Actually, it's one of those things where Feldman kind of fits in relatively well. The Eugenio O'Meara was the director on that. And I'm not like the one that people may have seen is Grand Piano with
Elijah Wood.
Yeah, I didn't think that was. I thought that was an okay movie.
It was an interesting premise, yeah.
Yeah, you're right. Interesting premise. It didn't completely pay off. It was going for Hitchcock. It ended up like Latter-day De Palma. But yeah. It wasn't. I didn't think it was terrible. It was. But The Birthday was like, looks like the first movie there. And I actually am intrigued to watch it again because it's been so long since I've seen it.
Yeah.
But that's one, those are two that I would throw out there that if you're, and it's possible that if you're a Lovecraft completist, you may have not, those two movies may have passed you by.
Yeah.
Possibly. There have been other ones. There was a Cthulhu movie from 2008 or 2009.
Yeah.
It was really pretty poor.
I think there's one with Tori Spelling in it.
That's the one I'm thinking of. It was pretty pretty terrible.
Yeah, don't search that one out.
So, yeah, really most of the movies that involve Cthulhu just have not been interesting. In some ways, Prometheus had elements of the Mountains of Madness in it, you know?
Yeah.
In a certain way, Prometheus was like the kind of like half-cocked attempt to make a Mountains of Madness story. I still personally would love to see the Mountains of Madness.
Yeah. Well, speaking of the Alien films too, Giger, I think, had to have been influenced by Lovecraft, you know, in some of his artwork. But with speaking into like Lovecraft going into different genres of art, there's definitely art inspired by Lovecraft. Like I mentioned earlier, like steampunk is very influenced by, you know, this idea of like, you know, futuristic 1930s with horror elements. And Nathan, you had mentioned earlier that you even found a beverage or a series of beverages that are kind of dedicated to Lovecraft. Can you tell me more about that?
Lovecraft Wines. It's lovecraftwines.com. I would love to have somebody from this fine establishment on the podcast to talk about it. I love that when you go to their website, it says Miskatonic University. They have the little like tag there, but then there's a quote. Have you seen the website yet, Seth?
No, I haven't checked it out
there
yet.
There are
look
just
at it
floating
now.
Clouds in the background, and it says almost, and it has a Lovecraft quote. The Lovecraft quote being, "Almost nobody dances sober unless they happen to be insane."
Oh, that's awesome.
So if you go to their store, their wine cult store, they have the Valentine's Day 2012 Old Vine Zinfandel. So they have these wines, and there's the Black Goat wine. There's a whole the Black Goat of the Woods wine cult. So you can join, and they even, there's different ones here. You have the Howler in the Darkness. You have the Gnarlathotep and the Cats of Ulthar 2010 California Cabernet Sauvignon. So I would love to try some of this. I don't know if I can get them to send us a bottle or not, but very interesting. I'd like to know if the wines are any good. I don't know if you can pick them up somewhere, like at an actual store, or if they're really only available online. But I definitely want to look into this a little bit more. So just lovecraftwines.com. It looks crazy. The art is interesting.
Yeah.
It's kind of like Flying Dog with tentacles.
Yes. For all your Faton needs.
Yes. But I'd definitely be into the art though on the Howler in the Darkness is
Yes.
quite impressive. It looks like two spinal columns mating, and they've got a great GIF of of
I'm
Cthulhu on
looking
there
at
as
that right
well.
now in the
Yeah,
cloud. Yeah,
like
that's
the
really cool.
lightning striking. It's I'm just trying to imagine some kind of heavy metal music playing behind it. Yeah, it looks like a fun painting with Pikmin. It looks like a fun kind of thing. So I don't know that much about them, but Lovecraft wine. So if you case, but Seth, you also mentioned to me, and I was not aware of this, that there is a sort of Lovecraft band or a band inspired by Lovecraft.
They're
I'm sure there
called.
are probably several, but.
Yeah, the biggest one is a Canadian group called the Darkest of the Hillside Thickets.
But of course they're
Of
Canadian.
course, yeah.
Yes.
But they've produced a couple of albums. They actually just released an album last year too. But they're halfway decent band. They're a rock band. But all their albums are pretty much named after Lovecraftian things, or some of their most of their song titles are Lovecraft themes as well too. I'm gonna try to pull them up here quickly if I can, and read you off a list of some of the things that you might see when you look up The Darkest of the Hillside Thickets. So their last album here was The Duke's.
Wake me up before you show goth.
they've had Tombstone Park, Great Old Ones, Cthulhu Strikes Back,
Cthulhu
Hymns
Strikes
of the
Back.
House of Horror, The Dukes of Alzerod. So yeah, these guys are totally into Lovecraft. So I'd definitely say to check them out.
And they're called what again?
The Darkest of the Hillside Thickets.
Darkest of the Hillside. Yeah, Darkest of the Hillside Thickets. That's
Yeah.
that's almost as good a band name as Butthole Surfer.
Yeah.
Wow. So there's a lot out there, and I wonder of all the horrors that Lovecraft himself imagined, if he ever imagined himself being so commercialized. I'm sure writing this stuff and dying more or less destitute, that this was probably not what he imagined.
No. I will tell people, if you've never read Lovecraft and you are getting into him, you have to be aware and that there is a lot of racism that will come up throughout some of Lovecraft's stories. I think it was just a product of his time.
Yeah.
Also because he was just so sheltered. I think he was also kind of like agoraphobic in a way, and I think this idea of people that were different from him coming was kind of bled into some of its themes. So when you do read his work, there is some of that in there that you will find.
Yeah, that's definitely true. It was kind of a product of his time. With Lovecraft too, and some of his contemporaries and people that he actually interacted with in his peer group, if you will, guys like Robert E. Howard, who created Conan the Barbarian. I mean, a lot of Howard's work has that same kind of stuff, has some of that those same unfortunate elements. It's worth mentioning that Lovecraft, in his own weird way, was definitely kind of a pioneer of a lot of different, like you said, even though his writing, his actual like dialogue and stuff wasn't always strong, some of the themes and the way he was able to incorporate those themes into fiction, make him a pretty impressive guy. You know, I think that his ability to tell horror stories that were outside of the norm of what a horror story was, where you didn't need to have Pickman's model is an excellent example. And that might be why it might have been very well adapted by Night Gallery. There's no need for special effects. There's no need for action scenes or you know, there's no violence really in that story. The horror all happens in perception, you know? And that was something that was true of some of Poe's stuff, but the way Lovecraft handled it, pretty interesting. I guess I should also throw out here that I remember a few years ago, and I think there might have been local guys of Baltimore, did a movie called The Call Girl of Cthulhu.
Oh, yes, I've heard of that. I have not seen that, but I have heard of
I did not see it either.
that.
There's a lot of good stuff out there. I think we've covered some of it, but certainly not all of it. What I'd hope to do next time we come across Lovecraft would really be to discuss some of his influence, things that influenced him, not his his experience, but authors out there, because I think that they're this brand of existential horror didn't begin with, by any means, with Lovecraft. It didn't really begin with Machen, but being able to look beyond just the kind of these human elements and human style horror are what set Lovecraft and some of these other guys apart. And female authors as well. So I'm looking forward to looking into that. Seth, thank you so much for joining us. It was a whole lot of fun.
My pleasure. Thanks, Nathan.
And we will see you guys next time. Take care.